Chapter 3. Crozier. Latitude, 70 degrees, 5 minutes north. Longitude, 98 degrees, 23 minutes west. October, 1847. Captain Crozier descends the short ladder to the lower deck, pushes through the sealed double doors, and almost staggers in the sudden blast of warmth. Even though the circulating hot water heat has been off for hours, body heat from more than 50 men and residual warmth from cooking have kept the temperature here on the lower deck high, just below freezing, almost 80 degrees warmer than outside. The effect on someone who's been out on deck for half an hour is the equivalent of walking into a sauna fully clothed. Since he's continuing down to the unheated orlop and hold decks, and thus keeping his cold weather slops on, Crozier doesn't tarry long here in the heat, but he does pause for a moment, as any captain would, taking the time to glance around and make sure that everything hasn't gone to hell in the half hour he's been away. Despite the fact that this is the only berthing, eating and living deck on the ship, it's still as dark as a working Welsh mine, with its small skylights snowed over in the daytime and the night, now 22 hours long. Whale oil lamps, lanterns or candles throw small cones of illumination here and there, but mostly the men make their way through the gloom by memory, remembering where to dodge the innumerable half-seen heaps and hanging masses of stored food, clothing, gear, and other men sleeping in their hammocks. When all the hammocks go up, 14 inches allowed per man, there will be no room to walk at all, except for two 18-inch wide aisles along the hull on either side. But only a few hammocks are up now, men catching some sleep before late watches, and the din of conversation, laughter, cursing, coughing, and Mr. Diggle's inspired clankings and obscenities is loud enough to drown out some of the press and moan of the ice. The ship's diagrams show 7 feet of clearance, but in reality, between the heavy ship's timbers overhead and the tons of lumber and extra wood stored on racks hanging from those timbers, there's less than 6 feet of headroom on this lower deck, and the few truly tall men on Terra, like the coward Manson waiting below, have to walk in a perpetual hunched-over posture. Francis Crozier is not that tall. Even with his cap and comforter on, he doesn't have to duck his head as he turns. To his right, and running aft from where Crozier stands, is what looks to be a low, dark, narrow tunnel, but is actually the companionway leading to the officers' quarters, a warren of 16 tiny sleeping cubicles and two cramped mess quarters for the officers and warrant officers. Crozier's cabin is the same size as the others, 6 feet by 5 feet. The companionway is dark and barely 2 feet wide. Only one man can pass at a time, ducking his head to avoid hanging stores, and heavy men have to turn sideways to shuffle down the narrow passage. The officers' quarters are crammed into 60 feet of the 96-foot length of the ship, and since Terra is only 28 feet wide here on the lower deck, the narrow companionway is the only straight-line access aft. Crozier can see light from the great cabin at the stern, where, even in this Stygian cold and gloom, some of his surviving officers are relaxing at the long table, smoking their pipes or reading from the 1,200-volume library shelved there. The captain hears music playing, one of the metal discs for the hand organ, playing a tune that had been popular in London music halls 5 years ago. Crozier knows that it's Lieutenant Hodgson playing the tune. It's his favourite, and it drives Lieutenant Edward Little, Crozier's executive officer and a lover of classical music, absolutely mad with irritation. All apparently being well in officer's country, Crozier turns and glances forward. The regular crew's quarters take up the remaining third of the length of the ship, 36 feet, but into it are crammed 41 of the surviving able-bodied seamen and midshipmen from the original ship's muster of 44. There are no classes being taught tonight, and it's less than an hour until they will unfurl their hammocks and turn in, so the majority of the men are sitting on their sea chests or heaps of stowed material, smoking or talking in the dim light. The centre of the space is taken up by the gigantic Fraser's patent stove, where Mr. Diggle is baking biscuits. Diggle, the best cook in the fleet as far as Crozier is concerned, and a prize, most literally, since Crozier had stolen the obstreperous cook right off Captain Sir John Franklin's flagship just before the expedition departed, is always cooking, usually biscuits, and curses and bangs and kicks and berates his assistants all the while. Men are literally scuttling near the giant stove, disappearing down the scuttle there to bring up stores from the lower decks, hurrying to avoid Mr. Diggle's voluble wrath. Fraser's patent stove itself appears, to Crozier's eye, almost as large as the locomotive engine in the hold. Besides, its gigantic oven and six large burners, the bulking iron contraption has a built-in desalinator and a prodigious hand pump to bring water in from either the ocean or the rows of huge water storage tanks down in the hold. But both the sea outside and the water in the hold now are frozen solid, so the huge pots bubbling on Mr. Diggle's burners are busy melting chunks of ice chipped out of the water tanks below and hauled up for that purpose. The captain can see, beyond the partition of Mr. Diggle's shelves and cupboards, where forward bulwarks had once stood, the sick bay in the forepeak of the ship. For 2 years there had been no sick bay. The area was stacked from deck to beams with more crates and casks, and those crewmen who needed to see the ship's surgeon or assistant surgeon at 7:30 a.m. lubber's time did so near Mr. Diggle's stove. But now, with the amount of stores depleted and the number of sick and injured men multiplying, the carpenters had created a more permanent and separate section of the forepeak to serve as sick bay. Still, the captain could see the tunnel-like entrance through the crates where they'd made a space for Lady Silence to sleep. That discussion had taken the better part of a day last June. Franklin had insisted that the Eskimo woman not be allowed on his ship. Crozier had accepted her, but his discussion with his executive officer, Lieutenant Little, as to where to berth her, had been almost absurd. Even an Eskimo wench, they knew, would freeze to death on deck or on the lower two decks, which left only the main lower deck. She certainly could not sleep in the crew's berthing area, even though they had empty hammocks by this time, thanks to that thing out on the ice. In Crozier's day as a teenaged lad before the mast, and then as a midshipman, women smuggled aboard were put in the lightless, almost airless, stinking hawser room in the lowest and most forward part of the ship, within reach of the forecastle for the lucky man or men who smuggled her aboard. But even last June, when Silence appeared, it was below zero in HMS Terror's hawser room. No, berthing her with the crew was not an idea to be considered. Officer's country? Perhaps. There were empty cabins, with some of his officers dead and torn apart. But both Lieutenant Little and his captain had quickly agreed that the presence of a woman just a few thin partitions and sliding doors away from the sleeping men would be unhealthy. What then? They couldn't assign her a sleeping place and then post an armed guard over her all the time. It was Edward Little who'd come up with the idea of shifting some stores to make a little cave of a sleeping area for the woman in the forepeak, where the sick bay would have been. The one person awake all night, every night, was Mr. Diggle, dutifully baking his biscuits and frying his breakfast meats. And if Mr. Diggle had ever had an eye for the ladies, it was apparent that day had long passed. Also, reasoned Lieutenant Little and Captain Crozier, the proximity to the Fraser's patent stove would help keep their guest warm. It had succeeded in that, all right. Lady Silence was made sick by the heat, forcing her to sleep stark naked on her furs in her little crate and cask cave. The captain discovered this by accident, and the image stayed with him. Now, Crozier takes a lantern from its hook, lights it, lifts the hatch, and goes down the ladder to the orlop deck before he starts to melt like one of those blocks of ice on the stove. To say it's cold on the orlop deck would be the kind of understatement Crozier knows he used to make before he first voyaged to the Arctic. A drop of 6 feet of ladder down from the lower deck has dropped the temperature at least 60 degrees. The darkness here is almost absolute. Crozier takes the usual captain's minute to look around. The circle of light from his lantern is weak, illuminating mostly the fog of his breath in the air. All around him is the labyrinth of crates, hogsheads, tins, kegs, casks, coal sacks, and canvas-covered heaps crammed deck to beams with the ship's remaining provisions. Even without the lantern, Crozier could find his way through the dark and rat screech here. He knows every inch of his ship. At times, especially late at night with the ice moaning, Francis Rawdon Moira Crozier realizes that HMS Terra is his wife, mother, bride, and whore. This intimate knowledge of a lady made of oak and iron, oakum and ballast, canvas and brass, is the one true marriage he can and will ever know. How could he have thought differently with Sophia? At other times, even later at night, when the ice's moaning turns to screams, Crozier thinks that the ship has become his body and his mind. Out there, out beyond the decks and hull, lies death, eternal cold. Here, even while frozen in the ice, there continues the heartbeat, however faint, of warmth and conversation and movement and sanity. But traveling deeper into the ship, Crozier realizes, is like traveling too deeply into one's body or mind. What one encounters there may not be pleasant. The orlop deck is the belly. This is where the food and needed resources are stored, each thing packed away in the order of its presumed need. Easy to hand for those driven down here by Mr. Diggle's shouts and blows. Lower, on the hold deck where he's headed, are the deep guts and kidneys, the water tanks, and the majority of the coal storage, and more provisions. But it's the mind analogy that bothers Crozier the most. Haunted and plagued by melancholia much of his life, knowing it as a secret weakness made worse by his 12 winters frozen in Arctic darkness as an adult, feeling it recently triggered into active agony by Sophia Cracroft's rejection, Crozier thinks of the partially lighted and occasionally heated but livable lower deck as the sane part of himself. The brooding mental lower world of the orlop deck is where he spends too much of his time these days, listening to the ice scream, waiting for the metal bolts and beam fastenings to explode from the cold. The bottom hold deck below, with its terrible smells and its waiting dead room, is madness. Crozier shakes such thoughts away. He looks down the orlop deck aisle, running forward between the piled casks and crates. The lantern's gleam is blocked by the bulkheads of the bread room, and the aisles on either side constrict to tunnels even narrower than the officer's country companionway on the lower deck above. Here men must squeeze between the bread room and the sleeves holding the last sacks of Terra's coal. The carpenter's storeroom is forward there on the starboard side, the bosun's storeroom opposite on the port side. Crozier turns and shines his lantern aft. Rats flee, somewhat lethargically, from the light, disappearing between casks of salt, meat, and crates of tinned provisions. Even in the dim lantern's glow, the captain can see that the padlock is secure on the spirit room. Every day, one of Crozier's officers will come down here to fetch the amount of rum needed for that day's doling out of the men's noonday grog. 1/4 pint of 140 proof rum to 3/4 pint of water. Also in the spirit room are stored the officer's wine and brandy, as well as 200 muskets, cutlasses and swords. As has always been the practice in the Royal Navy, scuttles lead directly from the officer's mess and great cabin overhead to the spirit room. Should there be a mutiny, the officers would get to the weapons first. Behind the spirit room is the gunner's storeroom, with its kegs of powder and shot. On either side of the spirit room are various storage and locker spaces, including chain cable lockers, the sail room with all its cold canvas, and the slop room, from which Mr. Helpman, the ship's clerk, issues their outdoor clothing. Behind the spirit room and the gunner's storeroom is the captain's storeroom, holding Francis Crozier's private, and personally paid for, hams, cheeses, and other luxuries. It is still the custom for the ship's captain to set the table from time to time for his officers, and while the victuals in Crozier's storeroom pale in comparison to the luxurious foodstuffs crammed into the late Captain Sir John Franklin's private store on Erebus, Crozier's pantry, almost empty now, has held out for 2 summers and 2 winters in the ice. Also, he thinks with a smile, it has the benefit of containing a decent wine cellar, from which the officers still benefit, and many bottles of whiskey, upon which he, the captain, depends. The poor commander, lieutenants and civilian officers aboard Erebus had done without spirits for 2 years. Sir John Franklin was a teetotaler, and so, when he was alive, had been his officer's mess. A lantern bobs towards Crozier down the narrow aisle, leading back from the bow. The captain turns in time to see something like a hairy black bear squeezing its bulk between the coal sleeves and the breadroom bulkhead. "Mr. Wilson," says Crozier, recognizing the carpenter's mate from his rotundity and from the sealskin gloves and deerskin trousers which had been offered to all the men before departure, but which only a few had chosen over their flannel and woolen slops. Sometime during the voyage out, the mate had sewn wolf skins they'd picked up at the Danish whaling station at Disko Bay into a bulky, but warm, he insisted, outer garment.
"Captain?"
Wilson, one of the fattest men aboard, is carrying the lantern in one hand and has several boxes of carpenter's tools tucked under his other arm.
"Mr. Wilson, my compliments to Mr. Honey, and would you ask him to join me on the hold deck?" "Aye, sir. Where on the hold deck, sir?"
"The dead room, Mr. Wilson." "Aye, sir." The lantern light reflects on Wilson's eyes as the mate keeps his curious gaze up just a second too long.
"And ask Mr. Honey to bring a pry bar, Mr. Wilson."
"Aye, sir."
Crozier stands aside, squeezing between two kegs to let the larger man pass up the ladder to the lower deck. The captain knows he might be rousing his carpenter for nothing, making the man go to the trouble of getting into his cold weather slops right before lights out for no good reason. But he has a hunch, and he'd rather disturb the man now than later. When Wilson has squeezed his bulk up through the upper hatch, Captain Crozier lifts the lower hatch and descends to the hold deck. Because the entire deck space lies beneath the level of outside ice, the hold deck is almost as cold as the alien world beyond the hull, and darker, with no aurora, stars, or moon to relieve the ever-present blackness. The air is thick with coal dust and coal smoke. Crozier watches the black particles curl around his hissing lantern like a banshee's claw, and it stinks of sewage and bilge. A scraping, sliding, scuttling noise comes from the darkness aft, but Crozier knows it's just the coal being shoveled in the boiler room. Only the residual heat from that boiler keeps the 3 inches of filthy water sloshing at the foot of the ladder from turning to ice. Forward, where the bow dips deeper into the ice, there is almost a foot of icy water, despite men working the pumps 6 hours and more a day. The Terror, like any living thing, breathes out moisture through a score of vital functions, including Mr. Diggle's ever-working stove. And while the lower deck is always damp and rimed with ice, and the orlop deck frozen, the hold is a dungeon, with ice hanging from every beam, and meltwater sloshing above one's ankles. The flat black sides of the 21 iron water tanks lining the hull on either side add to the chill. Filled with 38 tons of fresh water when the expedition sailed, the tanks are now armored icebergs, and to touch the iron is to lose skin. Magnus Manson is waiting at the bottom of the ladder, as Private Wilkes had said, but the huge, able-bodied seaman is standing, not sitting, arse on ladder. The big man's head and shoulders are hunched beneath the low beams. His pale, lumpy face and stubbled jowls remind Crozier of a rotten, white-peeled potato stuffed under a Welsh wig. He will not meet his captain's stare in the harsh lantern glow.
"What is this, Manson?"
Crozier's voice does not hold the bark he unleashed on his lookout and lieutenant. His tone is flat, calm, certain, with the power of flogging and hanging behind every syllable.
"It's them ghosts, Captain."
For a huge man, Magnus Manson has the high, soft voice of a child. When Terror and Erebus had paused at Disko Bay on the west coast of Greenland in July of 1845, Captain Sir John Franklin had seen fit to dismiss 2 men from the expedition, a marine private and a sailmaker from Terror. Crozier had made the recommendation that seaman John Brown and Private Aitken from his ship also be released. They were little better than invalids and never should have been signed on for such a voyage. But on occasion since, he wished he'd sent Manson home with those 4. If the big man was not feeble-minded, he was so close to it that it was impossible to tell the difference.
"You know there are no ghosts on Terror, Manson."
"Yes, Captain."
"Look at me."
Manson raises his face, but does not meet Crozier's gaze. The captain marvels at how tiny the man's pale eyes are in that white lump of a face.
"Did you disobey Mr. Thompson's orders to carry sacks of coal to the boiler room, Seaman Manson?
No, sir. Yes, sir.
Do you know the consequences of disobeying any order on this ship? Crozier feels like he's talking to a boy, although Manson must be at least 30 years old. The big sailor's face brightens as he is presented with a question he can answer correctly.
Oh, yes, Captain. Flogging, sir. 20 lashes. 100 lashes if I disobeys more than once. Hanging if I disobey a real officer rather than just Mr. Thompson.
That's correct, says Crozier. But did you know that the captain can also inflict any punishment he finds appropriate to the transgression? Manson peers down at him, his pale eyes confused. He has not understood the question. I'm saying I can punish you any way I see fit, Seaman Manson, says the captain. A flood of relief flows over the lumpy face.
Oh, yes, right, Captain.
Instead of 20 lashes, says Francis Crozier, I could have you locked up in the dead room for 20 hours with no light. Manson's already pale, frozen features lose so much blood that Crozier prepares to get out of the way if the big man faints.
You wouldn't.
The child man's voice quavers toward a vibrato. Crozier says nothing for a long, cold, lantern-hissing moment. He lets the sailor read his expression. Finally, he says, What do you think you hear, Manson? Has someone been telling you ghost stories? Manson opens his mouth, but seems to have trouble deciding which question to answer first. Ice forms on his fat lower lip.
Walker,
he says at last. You're afraid of Walker. James Walker, a friend of Manson's, who had been about the same age as the idiot and not much brighter, was the last man to die on the ice just a week earlier. Ship's rules required that the crew keep small holes drilled in the ice near the ship, even when the ice was 10 or 15 feet thick as it was now, so that they could get at water to fight a fire should one break out aboard. Walker and two of his mates were on just such a drilling party in the dark, reopening an old hole that would freeze in less than an hour unless rammed with metal spikes. The white terror had come out from behind a pressure ridge, torn off the seaman's arm and smashed his ribs to splinters in an instant, disappearing before the armed guards on deck could raise their shotguns. Walker told you ghost stories, says Crozier.
Yes, Captain. No, Captain. What Jimmy did was, he tells me the night before the thing killed him, he says, Magnus, should that L spawn out on the ice get me someday? He says, I'll come back in me white shroud to whisper in your ear how cold L is. So help me God, Captain, that's what Jimmy said to me. Now I hear him trying to get out.
As if on cue, the hull groans. The frigid deck moans under their feet. Metal brackets on the beams groan back in sympathy, and there is a scraping, clawing noise in the dark around them that seems to run the length of the ship. The ice is restless. Is that the sound you hear, Manson?
Yes, Captain. No, sir.
The dead room is 30 feet aft on the starboard side, just beyond the last metal-moaning iron water tank. But when the outside ice stops its noise, Crozier can hear only the muffled scrape and push of the shovels in the boiler room farther aft. Crozier's had enough of this nonsense.
You know your friend's not coming back, Magnus. He's there in the extra sail storage room, securely sewn into his own hammock with the other dead men, frozen solid, with three layers of our heaviest sail canvas tied around them. If you hear anything from in there, it's the damned rats trying to get at them. You know this, Magnus Manson.
Yes, Captain.
There will be no disobeying orders on this ship, Seaman Manson. You have to make up your mind now. Carry the coal when Mr. Thompson tells you to. Fetch the food stores when Mr. Diggle sends you down here. Obey all orders promptly and politely, or face the court, face me, and the possibility that you'll spend a cold, lanternless night in the dead room yourself. Without another word, Manson knuckles his forehead in salute, lifts a huge sack of coal from where he stowed it on the ladder, and hauls it aft into the darkness.
The engineer himself is stripped to his long-sleeved undershirt and corduroy trousers, shoveling coal alongside the ancient 47-year-old stoker named Bill Johnson. The other stoker, Luke Smith, is on the lower deck sleeping between his shoveling hours. Terra's lead stoker, young John Torrington, was the first man of the expedition to die on New Year's Day 1846. But that had been from natural causes. It seems Torrington's doctor had urged the 19-year-old to go to sea to cure his consumption, and he'd succumbed after 2 months of being an invalid while the ships were frozen in the harbour at Beachy Island that first winter. Doctors Peddy and MacDonald had told Crozier that the boy's lungs were as solidly packed with coal dust as a chimney sweep's pockets. "Thank you, Captain," says the young engineer between heaves of the shovel. Seaman Manson has just dropped off a second sack of the coal and gone back for a third. "You're welcome, Mr. Thompson." Crozier glances at Stoker Johnson. The man is 4 years younger than the captain, but looks 30 years older. Every seam and wrinkle on his age-molded face is outlined in coal black and grime. Even his toothless gums are soot grey. Crozier doesn't want to reprimand his engineer, and thus an officer, although civilian, in front of the stoker. But he says, "I presume we'll dispense with using Marines as messengers, should there be another such instance in the future, which I very much doubt." Thompson nods, uses the shovel to clang shut the iron grate on the boiler, leans on the tool and tells Johnson to go above to get him some coffee from Mr. Diggle. Crozier's glad the stoker is gone, but even happier that the grate is closed. The heat in here makes him slightly nauseated after the cold everywhere else. The captain has to wonder at the fate of his engineer. Warrant Officer James Thompson, Engineer First Class, graduate of the Navy's steam factory at Woolwich, the world's best training grounds for the new breed of steam propulsion engineers, is here, stripped to his filthy undershirt, shoveling coal like a common stoker in an ice-locked ship that hasn't moved an inch under its own power now for more than a year. "Mr. Thompson," says Crozier, "I'm sorry I haven't had a chance to talk to you today since you walked over to Erebus. Did you have a chance to confer with Mr. Gregory?" John Gregory is the engineer aboard the flagship.
"I did, Captain. Mr. Gregory's convinced that with the onset of real winter, they'll never be able to get at the damaged drive shaft. Even if they were able to tunnel down through the ice to replace the last propeller with the one they've jury-rigged, with the replacement drive shaft bent as badly as it is, Erebus is going nowhere under steam."
Crozier nods. Erebus bent its second drive shaft while the ship was throwing itself desperately on the ice more than a year ago. The flagship, heavier, with a more powerful engine, led the way through the pack ice that summer, opening leads for both ships. But the last ice they'd encountered before being frozen in for the last 13 months was harder than the iron in the experimental propeller screw and drive shaft. Divers that summer, all of who suffered frostbite and came close to dying, had confirmed not only that the screw had been shattered, but that the drive shaft itself was bent and broken. "Call," says the captain.
"Erebus has enough for, perhaps, 4 months of heating in the ice, at only 1 hour of hot water circulation through the lower deck per day, Captain. None at all for steaming next summer."
"If we get free next summer," thinks Crozier. After this last summer, when the ice never relented for a day, he's a pessimist. Franklin had used up Erebus's coal supply at a prodigious rate during those last weeks of freedom in the summer of 1846, sure that if he could smash through those last few miles of pack ice, the expedition would reach the open waters of the Northwest Passage along the northern coast of Canada, and they'd be drinking tea in China by late autumn.
"What about our coal use?" asks Crozier.
"Perhaps enough left for 6 months of heating," says Thompson, "but only if we cut back from 2 hours a day to one, and I recommend we do that soon, no later than the 1st of November."
That is less than 2 weeks away.
"And steaming," says Crozier.
If the ice relents at all next summer, Crozier plans to cram all the surviving men from Erebus aboard Terra and make an all-out effort to retreat the way they'd come, up the unnamed strait between Boothia Peninsula and Prince of Wales Island, down which they rushed 2 summers ago, past Walker Point and Barrow Strait, out through Lancaster Sound like a cork from a bottle, then rushing south into Baffin Bay with all sail set and the last coal being burned, going like smoke and oakum,
burning extra spars and furniture if need be to get the last bit of steam, anything to get them into open water off Greenland, where whalers could find them. But he'll also need steam to fight his way north through the south flowing ice to Lancaster Sound, even if a miracle occurs and they are released from the ice here. Crozier and James Ross once sailed Terra and Erebus out of the South Polar Ice, but they'd been travelling with the currents and bergs. Here in the damned Arctic, the ships have to sail for weeks against the flow of ice coming down from the pole just to reach the straits where they can escape. Thompson shrugs. The man looks exhausted.
If we cut off the heat on New Year's Day and somehow survive until next summer, we might get 6 days steaming without ice? Five?
Crozier merely nods again. This is almost certainly a death sentence for his ship, but not necessarily for the men of both ships. There is a sound out in the darkened corridor.
Thank you, Mr. Thompson.
The captain lifts his lantern off an iron hook, leaves the glow of the boiler room and heads forward in the slush and darkness. Thomas Honey is waiting in the corridor, his candle lantern sputtering in the bad air. He is holding the iron pry bar in front of him like a musket, clutched in thick gloves, and hasn't opened the bolted door of the dead room.
Thank you for coming, Mr. Honey, Crozier says to his carpenter.
Without explanation, the captain throws back the bolts and enters the freezing cold storage room. Crozier cannot resist lifting his lantern toward the aft bulkhead, where the six men's bodies have been stacked in their common canvas shroud. The heap is writhing. Crozier expected that, expected to see the movement of rats under the tarp, but he realizes that he's looking at a solid mass of rats above the shroud canvas as well. There is a solid cube of rats extending more than 4 feet above the deck as hundreds of them jostle for position to get at the frozen dead men. The squealing is very loud in here. More rats are underfoot, scuttling between his and the carpenter's legs. Rushing to the banquet, thinks Crozier, and showing no fear of the lantern light. Crozier turns the lantern back to the hull, walks up the slight incline caused by the ship's cant to port, and begins pacing along the curved, tilted wall. There. He holds the lantern closer.
Well, I'll be goddamned to hell and hanged for a heathen,
says Honey.
Pardon me, Captain, but I didn't think the ice would do this so soon.
Crozier doesn't answer. He crouches to investigate the bent and extended wood of the hull more closely. Hull planks have been bent inward here, bulging almost a foot from the graceful curve elsewhere along the hull's side. The innermost layers of wood have splintered, and at least two planks are hanging free.
Jesus God Christ Almighty,
says the carpenter, who has crouched next to the captain.
That ice is a fucking monster, begging the captain's pardon, sir.
Mr. Honey, says Crozier, his breath adding crystals to the ice already on the planks and reflecting the lantern light. Could anything but the ice have done this damage?
The carpenter barks a laugh, but stops abruptly as he realizes the captain is not making a joke. Honey's eyes widen, then squint.
Begging your pardon again, Captain, but if you mean that's impossible.
Crozier says nothing.
I mean, Captain, this hull was 3 inches of the finest English oak as it was, sir. And for this trip, for the ice, I mean, sir, it was double with 2 layers of African oak, Captain, each 1.5 inches thick. And them African oak panels was wrought on the diagonal, sir, giving it even more strength than if it were just doubled straight-like.
Crozier is inspecting the loose planks, trying to ignore the river of rats behind them and around them, as well as the chewing sounds from the direction of the aft bulkhead.
And, sir,
continues Honey, his voice hoarse in the cold, his rum-tainted breath freezing in the air,
on top of the 3 inches of English oak and the 3 inches of diagonal-laid African oak, they laid on 2 layers of Canadian elm, sir, each 2 inches thick. That's 4 more inches of hull, Captain, and that wrought diagonal against the African oak. That's 5 belts of serious timber, sir, 10 inches of the strongest wood on earth between us and the sea.
The carpenter shuts up, realizing that he's lecturing his captain on details of the shipyard's work that Crozier had personally overseen in the months before departure. The captain stands,
and sets his mittened hand against the innermost planks where they have come free. There's more than an inch of open space there. Set your lantern down, Mr. Honey. Use your pry bar to lever this loose. I want to see what the ice has done to the outer layer of hull oak. The carpenter complies. For several minutes, the sound of the iron bar prying at iron-cold wood and the carpenter's grunts almost drown out the frenzied gnawing of the rats behind them. The bent Canadian elm tears back and falls away. The shattered African oak is leveraged out. Only the inward-bent original oak of the hull remains now as Crozier steps closer, holding his lantern so that both men can see. Shards and spears of ice reflect the lantern light through the foot-long holes in the hull, but in the center is something much more disturbing. Blackness. Nothing. A hole in the ice. A tunnel. Honey bends a piece of the splintered oak farther in so Crozier can shine his lantern on it.
Holy fucking Jesus Christ fucking shit almighty,
gasps the carpenter. This time he does not ask his captain's pardon. Crozier has the temptation to lick his dry lips, but knows how painful that will be here where it's 50 below in the dark. But his heart is pounding so wildly that he's also tempted to steady himself with one mitten against the hull, the way the carpenter has just done. The freezing air from outside rushes in so quickly that it almost extinguishes the lantern. Crozier has to shield it with his free hand to keep it flickering, sending the men's shadows dancing across the decks, beams, and bulkheads. The two long boards from the outer hull have been smashed and bent inward by some inconceivable, irresistible force. Clearly visible in the light from the slightly shaking lantern are huge claw marks in the splintered oak. Claw marks streaked with frozen smears of impossibly bright blood. Chapter 4. Good Sir. Latitude 75 degrees 12 minutes north. Longitude 61 degrees 6 minutes west. Baffin Bay, July 1845. From the private diary of Dr. Harry D. S. Good Sir.
11 April 1845. In a letter to my brother today, I wrote, "All the officers are in great hopes of making the passage, and hope to be in the Pacific end of next summer. I confess that, however selfish it is, my own hope for the expedition is that it may take us a bit longer to reach Alaska, Russia, China, and the warm waters of the Pacific. Although trained as an anatomist and signed on by Captain Sir John Franklin as a mere assistant surgeon, I am in truth no mere surgeon, but a doctor, and I confess further that as amateurish as my attempts may be, I hope to become something of a naturalist on this voyage. While having no personal experience with Arctic flora and fauna, I plan to become personally acquainted with the life forms in the icy realms to which we set sail only a month from now. I am especially interested in the white bear, although most accounts of it one hears from whalers and old Arctic hands tend to be too fabulous to credit. I recognize that this personal diary is most out of the ordinary. The official log that I shall begin when we depart next month will record all of the pertinent professional events and observations of my time aboard HMS Erebus in my capacity as assistant surgeon and as a member of Captain Sir John Franklin's expedition to force the Northwest Passage. But I feel that something more is due, some other record, some more personal account, and even if I should never let another soul read this after my return, it is my duty, to myself if no other, to keep these notes. All I know at this point is that my expedition with Captain Sir John Franklin already promises to be the experience of a lifetime. Sunday, 18 May, 1845. All the men are aboard, and although last-minute preparation is still going on around the clock for tomorrow's departure, especially with the stowing of what Captain Fitzjames informs me is more than 8,000 cans of tinned food, which have arrived only in the nick of time, Sir John conducted divine service today for us aboard Erebus and for as many of Terror's crew who wished to join us. I noted that Terror's captain, an Irishman named Crozier, was not in attendance. No one could have attended the lengthy service
and heard the very lengthy sermon by Sir John today without being deeply moved. I wonder if any ship from any nation's navy has ever been captained by such a religious man. There is no doubt that we are truly and safely and irrevocably in God's hands on the voyage to come. 19 May 1845. What a departure! Having never gone to sea before, much less as a member of such a heralded expedition, I had no idea of what to expect, but nothing could have prepared me for the glory of this day. Captain Fitzjames estimates that more than 10,000 well-wishers and persons of importance crowded the docks at Greenhithe to see us off. Speeches resounded until I thought we would never be allowed to depart while daylight still filled the summer sky. Bands played. Lady Jane, who has been staying aboard with Sir John, went down the gangplank to a rousing series of hurrahs from we 60-some Erebuses. Bands played again. Then the cheers started, as all lines were cast off, and for several minutes the noise was so deafening that I could not have heard an order had Sir John himself shouted it in my ear. Last night, Lieutenant Gore and Chief Surgeon Stanley were kind enough to inform me that it is custom during sailing for the officers not to show emotion. So, although only technically an officer, I stood with the officers lined up in their fine blue jackets and tried to restrain all displays of emotion, however manly. We were the only ones doing so. The seamen shouted and waved handkerchiefs and hung from the ratlines, and I could see many a rouged dockside doxy waving farewell to them. Even Captain Sir John Franklin waved a bright red and green handkerchief at Lady Jane, his daughter Eleanor, and his niece Sophia Cracroft, who waved back until the sight of the docks was obstructed by the following terror. We are being towed by steam tugs and followed on this leg of our voyage by HMS Rattler, a powerful new steam frigate and also a hired transport ship carrying our provisions, Barretto Jr. Just before Erebus pushed away from the docks, a dove landed high on the main mast. Sir John's daughter by his first marriage, Eleanor, then quite visible in her bright green silk dress and emerald parasol, cried out, but could not be heard above the cheers and bands. Then she pointed, and Sir John and many of the officers looked up, smiled, and then pointed out the dove to others aboard ship. Combined with the words spoken in yesterday's divine service, this, I have to assume, is the best possible omen. 4 July 1845. What a terrible crossing of the North Atlantic to Greenland. For 30 stormy days, even while under tow, the ship has been tossing, rolling, and wallowing, its tightly sealed gun ports on each side barely 4 feet out of the water during the downward rolls, sometimes barely making headway. I've been terribly seasick for 28 of the last 30 days. Lieutenant Le Vicomte tells me that we never made more than 5 knots, which, he assures me, is a terrible time for any ship merely under sail, much less for such a miracle of technology as Erebus and our companion craft Terror, both capable of steaming along under the impetus of their invincible screws. 3 days ago we rounded Cape Farewell at the southern tip of Greenland, and I confess that the glimpses of this huge continent, with its rocky cliffs and endless glaciers coming right down to the sea, lay as heavily on my spirits as the pitching and rolling did upon my stomach. Good God, this is a barren, cold place, and this in July. Our morale is top-notch, however, and all aboard trust to Sir John's skill and good judgment. Yesterday, Lieutenant Fairholme, the youngest of our lieutenants, said to me in confidence, I never felt the captain was so much my companion with anyone I have sailed with before. Today we put in at the Danish whaling station here in Disko Bay. Tons of supplies are being transferred from Barretto Jr., and 10 live oxen transported aboard that ship were slaughtered this afternoon. All the men of both expedition ships shall feast on fresh meat tonight. 4 men were dismissed from the expedition today, upon advice of the 4 of us surgeons, and will be returning to England with the tow and transport ship. These include 1 man from Erebus, a certain Thomas Burt, the ship's armourer, and 3 from Terror, a marine private named Aitken, a seaman named John Brown, and Terror's primary sailmaker, James Elliot. That brings our total muster down to 129 men for the 2 ships.
dried fish from the Danes, and a cloud of coal dust hang over everything this afternoon. Hundreds of bags of coal were transferred from Barretto Junior today, and the seamen aboard Erebus are busy with the smooth-sided stones they call holy stones, scrubbing and re-scrubbing the deck clean while the officers shout encouragement. Despite the extra work, all hands are in high spirits because of the promise of tonight's feasting and extra rations of grog. Besides the four men to be invalided home, Sir John will be sending the June musters, official dispatches, and all personal letters back with Barretto Jr. Everyone will be busy writing the next few days. After this week, the next letter to reach our loved ones will be posted from Russia or China. 12 July, 1845. Another departure, this time perhaps the last one before the Northwest Passage. This morning we slipped our cables and sailed west from Greenland, while the crew of Barretto Jr. gave us three hearty hurrahs and waved their caps. Surely these shall be the last white men we see until we reach Alaska. 26 July, 1845. Two whalers, Prince of Wales and Enterprise, have anchored nearby to where we have tied up to a floating ice mountain. I have enjoyed many hours talking to the captains and crewmen about white bears. I also had the distinct terror, if not pleasure, of climbing that huge iceberg this morning. The sailors scrambled up early yesterday, chipping steps into the vertical ice with their axes, and then rigging fixed lines for the less agile. Sir John ordered an observatory to be set atop the giant berg, which towers more than twice as tall as our highest mast. And while Lieutenant Gore and some of the officers from Terra take atmospheric and astronomical measurements up there, they have erected a tent for those spending the night atop the precipitous ice mountain. Our expedition ice masters, Mr. Reed from Erebus and Mr. Blanky from Terra, spend the daylight hours staring west and north through their brass telescopes, seeking, I am informed, the most likely path through the near solid sea of ice already formed there. Edward Couch, our very reliable and voluble mate, tells me that this is very late in the Arctic season for ships to be seeking any passage, much less the fabled Northwest Passage. The sight of both Erebus and Terra moored to the iceberg below us, a maze of ropes, what I must remember to call lines now that I am an old nautical hand, holding both ships fast to the ice mountain. The two ships' highest crow's nests below my precarious and icy perch, so high above everything, created a sort of sick and thrilling vertigo within me. It was exhilarating, standing up there hundreds of feet above the sea. The summit of the iceberg was almost the size of a cricket pitch, and the tent holding our meteorological observatory looked quite incongruous on the blue ice. But my hopes for a few moments of quiet reverie were shattered by the constant shotgun blasts, as the men all over the summit of our ice mountain were shooting birds, Arctic terns, I am told, by the hundreds. These heaps and heaps of fresh-killed birds shall be salted and stored away, although heaven alone knows where those additional casks shall be stored, since both our ships are already groaning and riding low under the weight of all their stores. Dr. MacDonald, assistant surgeon aboard HMS Terra, my counterpart there, as it were, has theories that heavily salted food is not as efficient and antisorbutic as fresh or non-salted victuals, and since the regular seamen aboard both ships prefer their salted pork to all other meals, Dr. MacDonald worries that the heavily salted birds will add little to our defences against scurvy. However, Stephen Stanley, our surgeon aboard Erebus, dismisses these worries. He points out that besides the 10,000 cases of preserved cooked meats aboard Erebus, our tinned rations alone include boiled and roast mutton, veal, all forms of vegetables including potatoes, carrots, parsnips and mixed vegetables, wide varieties of soups, and 9,450 pounds of chocolate. An equal weight, 9,300 pounds of lemon juice has also been brought as our primary antisorbutic measure. Stanley informs me that even when the juice is sweetened with liberal dollops of sugar, the common men hate their daily ration, and that one of our primary jobs as surgeons on the expedition is to ensure that they swallow the stuff.
It was interesting to me that almost all of the hunting by the officers and men of both our ships is done almost exclusively with shotguns. Lieutenant Gore assures me that each ship carries a full arsenal of muskets. Of course, it only makes sense to use shotguns to hunt birds, such as those killed by the hundreds today, but even back at Disko Bay, when small parties went out hunting caribou and Arctic fox, the men, even the Marines obviously trained in the use of muskets, preferred to take along shotguns. This, of course, must be the result of habit as much as preference. The officers tend to be English gentlemen who have never used muskets or rifles in their hunting, and except for the use of single-shot weapons in close-quarters naval combat, even the Marines have used shotguns almost exclusively in their past hunting experience. Will shotguns be enough to bag the great white bear? We've not seen one of those wondrous creatures yet, although every experienced officer in hand reassures me that we shall encounter them as soon as we enter the pack ice, and if not then, certainly when we winter over, should we be compelled to do so. Truly, the tales the whalers here tell me of the elusive white bears are wonderful and terrifying. As I write these words, I am informed that current or wind, or perhaps the necessities of the whaling business itself, have carried both whalers, Prince of Wales and Enterprise, away from our moorings here at our Ice Mountain. Captain Sir John shall not be dining with one of the whaling captains, Captain Martin of Enterprise, I believe, as had been planned for this evening. Perhaps more pertinent, Mate Robert Sargent has just informed me that our men are bringing down the astronomical and meteorological instruments, striking the tent and reeling in the hundreds of yards of fixed rope, line, which allowed my ascent earlier today. Evidently the ice masters, Captain Sir John, Commander Fitzjames, Captain Crozier, and the other officers have determined our most promising path through the ever-shifting pack ice. We are to cast off from our little iceberg home within minutes, sailing northwest as long as the seemingly endless Arctic twilight allows us to. We shall be beyond the reach of even the hardy whalers from this point on. As far as the world beyond our intrepid expedition is concerned, as Hamlet said, the rest is silence.
Chapter 5. Crozier. Latitude. 70 degrees, 5 minutes north. Longitude, 98 degrees, 23 minutes west. 9th November, 1847. Crozier is dreaming about the picnic to the platypus pond and of Sophia stroking him underwater when he hears the sound of a shot and comes crashing awake. He sits up in his bunk, not knowing what time it is, not knowing if it is day or night. Although there is no line between day and night any longer, since the sun has disappeared this very day, not to reappear until February. But even before he lights the small lantern in his berth to check his watch, he knows that it is late. The ship is as quiet as it ever gets, silent except for the creak of tortured wood and frozen metal within, silent except for the snores, the mumbles, and the farts from the sleeping men, and curses from Mr. Diggle the cook, silent. Save for the incessant groaning, banging, cracking, and surging of the ice outside, and added to those exceptions to silence this night, silent but for the banshee screech of a high wind. But this is no sound of ice or wind that wakes Crozier. It is a gunshot, a shotgun, muffled through the layers of oak planks and overlaying snow and ice, but a shotgun blast, without doubt. Crozier was sleeping with most of his clothes on, and now has pulled on most of the other layers, and is ready for his cold weather slops when Thomas Jobson, his steward, knocks on the door with his distinctive soft triple rap. The captain slides it open.
"Trouble on deck, sir,"
Crozier nods.
"Who's on watch tonight, Thomas?"
His pocket watch shows him that it is almost 3 a.m., civilian time. His memory of the months and days' watch schedule gives him the names an instant before Jobson speaks them aloud.
"Billy Strong and Private Heather, sir."
Crozier nods again, lifts a pistol from his cupboard, checks the priming, sets it in his belt, and squeezes past the steward, out through the officer's dining cubicle that borders the captain's tiny cabin on the starboard side, and then quickly forward, through another door to the main ladderway. The lower deck is mostly dark at this time in the morning, the glow around Mr. Diggle's stove the primary exception,
but lamps are being lit in several of the officers' mates and steward's quarters as Crozier pauses at the base of the ladder to pull his heavy slops from the hook and struggle into them. Doors slide open. First Mate Hornby walks aft to stand next to Crozier by the ladder. First Lieutenant Little hurries forward down the companionway, carrying three muskets and a sabre. He's followed by Lieutenants Hodgson and Irving, who are also carrying weapons. Forward of the ladder, seamen are grumbling from deep in their hammocks, but a second mate is already turning out a work party, literally tumbling sleeping men from their hammocks and shoving them aft toward their slops and the waiting weapons.
"Has anyone been up top yet to check out the shot?" Crozier asks his first mate.
"Mr. Mail had a duty, sir," says Hornby. "He went up as soon as he sent your steward to fetch you."
Reuben Mail is captain of the forecastle. A steady man. Billy Strong, the seaman on port watch up there, has been to sea before, Crozier knows, on HMS Belvedere. He wouldn't have shot at phantoms. The other man on watch was the oldest, and in Crozier's estimation, the stupidest of the surviving Marines, William Heather. At age 35 and still a private, frequently sick, too often drunk, and most frequently useless, Heather had almost been sent home from Disco Island 2 years before when his best friend Billy Aitken was discharged and sent back on HMS Rattler. Crozier slips the pistol into the oversized pocket of his heavy woolen outer coat, accepts a lantern from Jopson, wraps a comforter around his face, and leads the way up the tilted ladder. Crozier sees that it is as black as the inside of an eel's belly outside. No stars, no aurora, no moon, and cold. The temperature on deck registered 63 degrees below zero 6 hours earlier, when young Irving had been sent up to take measurements. And now a wild wind howls past the stubs of masts and across the canted, icy deck, driving heavy snow before it. Stepping out from beneath the frozen canvas enclosure above the main hatch, Crozier holds his mittened hand alongside his face to protect his eyes and sees a lantern gleam on the starboard side. Reuben Mail is on one knee over Private Heather, who is lying on his back, his cap and Welsh wig knocked off, and Crozier sees part of his skull knocked away as well. There seems to be no blood, but Crozier can see the Marine's brains sparkling in the lantern light. Sparkling, the captain realizes, because there is already a sheen of ice crystals on the pulped grey matter.
"He's still alive, Captain,"
says the forecastle chief.
"Jesus fucking Christ,"
says one of the crewmen crowded behind Crozier.
"Belay that," cries the first mate. "No fucking profanity. Speak when you're fucking spoken to, Crisp."
Hornsby's voice is a cross between a mastiff's growl and a bull's snort.
"Mr. Hornby," says Crozier, "assign Seaman Crisp to get below double quick and bring up his own hammock to carry Private Heather below."
"Aye, sir,"
say Hornby and the seaman in unison. The pounding of running boots is felt, but goes unheard over the wind screech. Crozier stands and swings his lantern in a circle. The heavy railing where Private Heather was standing watch at the base of the iced over ratlines has been smashed away. Beyond the gap, Crozier knows, the heaped ice and snow runs down like a toboggan ramp for 30 feet or more, but most of that ramp is not visible in the blinding snow. There are no prints visible in the small circle of snow illuminated by the captain's lantern. Reuben Mail lifts Heather's musket.
"It wasn't fired, Captain. In this storm, Private Heather couldn't have seen the thing until it was right on him," says Lieutenant Little.
"What about Strong?" asks Crozier.
Mail points towards the opposite side of the ship.
"Missing, Captain."
To Hornby, Crozier says, "Choose a man and stay with Private Heather until Crisp is back with the hammock and carry him below." Suddenly, both surgeons, Peddy and his assistant MacDonald, appear in the circle of lamplight, MacDonald wearing only light slops.
"Jesus Christ,"
says the chief surgeon, kneeling next to the Marine.
"He's breathing."
"Help him if you can, John," says Crozier.
He points to Mail and the rest of the seamen crowding around.
"The rest of you, come with me. Have your weapons ready to fire, even if you have to take your mittens off to do it. Wilson, carry both those lanterns. Lieutenant Little, please go below and choose 20 more good men. Issue full slops. And arm them with muskets, not shotguns. Muskets."
"Aye, sir,"
Little shouts over the wind,
but Crozier is already leading the procession forward, around the heaped snow and vibrating canvas pyramid amidships and up the canted deck toward the port lookout station. William Strong is gone. A long wool comforter has been shredded, and the tatters of it, caught in the manlines here, are flapping wildly. Strong's greatcoat, Welsh wig, shotgun, and one mitten are lying near the railing, in the lee of the port privy, where men on watch huddle to stay out of the wind, but William Strong is gone. There is a smear of red ice on the railing, where he must have been standing when he saw the large shape coming at him through the blowing snow. Without saying a word, Crozier dispatches two armed men with lanterns aft, three more toward the bow, another with a lantern to look beneath the canvas amidships.
"Rig a ladder here, please, Bob,"
he says to the second mate. The mate's shoulders are hidden under heaps of fresh, that is, not yet frozen, rope he's carried up from below. The ladder goes over the side within seconds. Crozier leads the way down. There is more blood on the ice and snow heaped along the exposed portside hull of the ship. Streaks of blood, looking quite black in the lantern light, lead out beyond the fireholes into the ever-changing maze of pressure ridges and ice spires, all more sensed than seen in the darkness.
"It wants us to follow it out there, sir,"
says Second Lieutenant Hodgson, leaning close to Crozier so as to be heard over the wind howl.
"Of course it does," says Crozier, "but we're going anyway. Strong might still be alive. We've seen that before with this thing."
Crozier looks behind him. Besides Hodgson, only three men had followed him down the rope ladder. All the rest were either searching the upper deck or were busy hauling Private Heather below decks. There is only one other lantern here besides the captain's.
"Armitage," Crozier says to the gunroom steward,
whose white beard is already filled with snow,
"give Lieutenant Hodgson your lantern, and you go with him. Gibson, you remain here and tell Lieutenant Little where we've headed when he comes down with the main search party. Tell him for God's sake not to let his men fire at anything unless they're sure it's not one of us."
"Yes, Captain."
To Hodgson, Crozier says,
"George, you and Armitage head out about 20 yards that way, toward the bow, then stay parallel to us as we search south. Try to keep your lantern within sight of ours."
"Aye, aye, sir."
"Tom,"
Crozier says to the only remaining man, young Evans,
"you come with me. Keep your Baker rifle ready, but only at half cock."
"Aye, sir."
The boy's teeth are chattering. Crozier waits until Hodgson reaches a point 20 yards to their right, his lantern only the dimmest glow in the blowing snow, and then he leads Evans out into the maze of seracs, ice pinnacles, and pressure ridges, following the periodic smears of blood on the ice. He knows that a delay of even a few minutes will be enough to blow snow over the faint trail. The captain doesn't even bother to remove the pistol from the pocket of his greatcoat. Less than 100 yards out, just where the lanterns of the men on the deck of HMS Terror become invisible, Crozier reaches a pressure ridge, one of those great heaps of ice thrown up by the ice plates grinding and surging against each other beneath the surface. For 2 winters in the ice now, Crozier and the other men of the late Sir John Franklin's expedition have watched these pressure ridges appear as if by magic, rise with a great rumbling and tearing sound, and then extend themselves across the surface of the frozen sea, sometimes moving faster than a man can run. This ridge is at least 30 feet high, a great vertical rubble of ice boulders, each at least as large as a hansom cab. Crozier walks along the ridge, extending his lantern as high as he can. Hodgson's lantern is no longer visible to the west. Nowhere around Terror is the view simple any longer. Everywhere the snow seracs, drifts, pressure ridges, and ice pinnacles block one's line of sight. There is one great ice mountain in the mile separating Terror and Erebus, and half a dozen more in sight on a moonlit night. But no icebergs here tonight, only this 3-story tall pressure ridge.
"There!"
shouts Crozier over the wind. Evans steps closer, his Baker rifle raised. A smear of black blood on the white wall of ice. The thing had carried William Strong up this small mountain of icy rubble, taking an almost vertical route. Crozier begins climbing, holding the lantern in his right hand, while he searches with his mittened free hand, trying to find cracks and crevices for his frozen fingers and already icy boots.
He hadn't taken time to put on his pair of boots, in which Jopson had driven long nails through the soles, giving traction on such ice surfaces. And now, his ordinary seaman's boots slip and skitter on the ice. But he finds more frozen blood 25 feet up, just below the ice-jumbled summit of the pressure ridge. So Crozier holds the lantern steady with his right hand, while kicking against a tilting ice slab with his left leg and leveraging himself up to the top, the wool of his greatcoat rasping against his back. The captain can't feel his nose, and his fingers are also numb.
"Captain!"
calls Evans from the darkness below.
"Do you want me to come up?"
Crozier is panting too hard to speak for a second, but when he gets his wind back, he calls down,
"No, wait there."
He can see the faint glow of Hodgson's lantern now to the northwest. That team isn't within 30 yards of the pressure ridge yet. Flailing for balance against the wind, leaning far to his right as the gale streams his comforter straight out to his left and threatens to topple him off his precarious perch, Crozier holds the lantern out over the south side of the pressure ridge. The drop here is almost vertical for 35 feet. There is no sign of William Strong, no sign of black smears on the ice, no sign that anything living or dead has come this way. Crozier can't imagine how anything could have found its way down that sheer ice face. Shaking his head and realizing that his eyelashes are almost frozen to his cheeks, Crozier begins descending the way he'd come, twice almost falling onto the rising bayonets of ice before slip-sliding the last 8 feet or so to the surface, where Evans is waiting. But Evans is gone. The Baker rifle lies in the snow, still at half-cock. There are no prints in the swirling snow, human or otherwise.
"Evans!"
Captain Francis Rawdon Moira Crozier's voice has been trained to command for 35 years and more. He can make it heard over a sou'westerly gale or while a ship is white foaming its way through the Strait of Magellan in an ice storm. Now he puts every bit of volume he can muster into the shout.
"Evans!"
No answer, except the howl of the wind. Crozier lifts the Baker rifle, checks the priming, and fires it into the air. The crack sounds muffled, even to him, but he sees Hodgson's lantern suddenly turn toward him, and three more lanterns become dimly visible on the ice from the direction of terror. Something roars, not 20 feet from him. It could be the wind, finding a new route through or around an icy serac, or pinnacle, but Crozier knows that it isn't. He sets the lantern down, fumbles in his pocket, pulls the pistol out, tugs off his mitten with his teeth, and, with just a thin woolen glove between his flesh and the metal trigger, holds the useless weapon in front of him.
"Come on, goddamn your eyes," Crozier screams. "Come out and try me instead of a boy, you hairy arse-licking, rat-fucking, piss-drinking spawn of a poxy Highgate whore."
There is no answer except the howl of the wind.